Cooking is not about just joining the dots, following one recipe slavishly and then moving on to the next. It's about developing an understanding of food, a sense of assurance in the kitchen, about the simple desire to make yourself something to eat. And in cooking, as in writing, you must please yourself to please others. Strangely, it can take enormous confidence to trust your own palate, follow your own instincts without habit, which itself is just trial and error. And this can be harder than following the most elaborate of recipes. But it's what works, what's important.
These are the opening words of a book called How to Eat by Nigella Lawson, which is celebrating 20 years since its publication in 2018. In those 20 years, Nigella has become a household name, not only in Ireland and Britain, but all around the world. And this week, we are delighted to say, our guest is Nigella Lawson. I'm Russell.
I'm Patrick, and this is Chew the Fat.
I'm Nigella Lawson, and I'm a food writer. And that's really how I would describe myself.
How many books have you written now?
I have written 11, which is extraordinary to me. But there it is.
No, we've never heard of them, have we now?
I haven't got a single copy myself.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on Chew the Fat with us this week.
It's a pleasure.
And welcome to Dublin.
Thank you.
You had your show last night at the National Concert Hall. And what a crowd. It was a great evening. Did you enjoy it yourself? Yeah,
I loved it. It was very relaxed and warm, which is what I would expect from Dublin. Mm.
You spoke about your love of Ireland. Mm-mm. And you mentioned about the Irish way of speaking.
Yes.
And the Irish way of acting in a pub. You mentioned.
Wait, everyone laughed and I loved when that. I said that, you know, that when I first came to Ireland when I was quite young, I just thought the conversations were so great because everyone laughed at me when I said at the concert hall that the conversation often seemed quite profound and everyone laughed. And I know they meant, oh, everyone's been drinking a lot. But I don't know that I think that. I think that what I love, and it's awful to generalise because obviously everyone is different, but there seems to be an Irish respect for conversation. Mm-hmm. And it means that you can talk about any manner of subjects. They can be deep, they can be everyday, it doesn't matter, and they're all accorded the same respect.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite important, and it actually translates very well to what I think about food. Mm. And in the same way, I was talking about how I love the way the Irish speak, and the way they also kind of love the way they speak, and absolutely relish the words as they come out of their mouth. Mm. And in the same, to me, that's very similar to, in a way, when I write, I love language, mm-hmm. and it's important. And I also love food when I eat it and the taste. It's the idea of just relishing the taste of words, of food, of ingredients. Mm-hmm.
And so, speaking of writing, How to Eat came out 20 years ago. How has your writing evolved over those 20 years?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think that I'm not sure my writing has evolved extraordinarily. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think maybe it's a bit simpler. But I do feel everything I write actually still has its genesis in How to Eat. Mm-hmm. And there are certain thoughts or streams of thought that existed in there, which I develop later. And many of my books, I think, owe something to How to Eat. But I develop certain ideas. I think, you know, one book that I wrote, Feast, very much took How to Eat in another way, which was How to Eat was very much how food means something in the everyday context of our lives. And Feast wanted to investigate how one thing that all of us as human beings, no matter what culture we come from, have in common is that we use food to celebrate. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter whether you cook a birthday cake or go out to a restaurant to celebrate an anniversary, a job promotion, a birthday. And I think that interested me, and that was taking the celebratory aspect. Mm-hmm. But it all comes from there. But in terms of writing, I think it's very hard really to change your writing style any more than to change your talking style, because if you have your own voice, you're not going to change radically. Every now and then I suppose I think it's going to be simpler, or because maybe How to Eat in some cases was very florid. But I think I'm not sure. A reader might find it easier to say which way I've developed my language, but I feel it's always the same. Mm. I mean, I may say different things, but my manner of delivery is much the same.
And in terms of the titles of the books,
yes.
Do they come at the start of the process or at the end?
They normally come at the beginning, but in a way, the beginning is an odd place because it's not quite the beginning. Because the beginning means when you start talking to a publisher. Yeah. Whereas actually, the book often has been germinating for a while. And I have an idea of the recipes or the food I want to talk about, but I always think I get an idea for a title before I talk to a publisher. I always think it's always easier for them as well. But so it's when the idea has come above ground, so it's not actually the beginning. Yeah. So I knew when I was wanted to write a book about the Italian influences in my life, I knew I wanted to write a book like that. But, and then, you know, because I do have a camp side to me, you know, shock, horror, not news.
This is new to us.
So then I had this idea of calling it Nigelissima. Yeah. But I did sort of have a notion of writing about Italian food or how it translates into my kitchen, which is not an Italian kitchen. But I like titles.
Yeah. Mm. Can you believe that we're so into food and we've never been to Italy ever before?
And we're completely ashamed of that.
Oh, don't be ashamed of anything. Don't be ashamed. Just be absolutely glad that you've got that to look forward to.
Exactly.
It's a bit like when people say they haven't read a certain book. I think, oh, how wonderful to have that for the first time.
Yeah.
So I don't think you. I'm very ill-traveled, actually. So I don't. So there are so many countries I haven't gone to and feel I should and
want to.
Is there
any in particular?
Well, I'd love to go to Japan.
Oh, wow, yes.
I would really like to go to... I mean, I'd really like to go to Japan, I have to say, and eat there. But pretty well everywhere, actually. I mean, I haven't been to Malaysia, and I know that'd be wonderful. Mm. Singapore is where I would like to go and eat. I'd like to do a two-day solid eat-a-thon.
Wow.
Oh, this sounds like a dream. Yeah. Should be a travel blogger as well.
Do you know what? I have written, when I was a journalist, I sometimes wrote travel pieces. I didn't enjoy it because I felt unrelaxed because I was always, I could never just be in the moment and enjoy what I was doing because I kept thinking, oh, I've got to find something to write about later. Yeah. And I found that difficult. My husband, John, was a travel writer and he was a wonderful travel writer. I don't know if you ever read any of his travel writing. I ought to get some for you. He was such a great travel writer and he never worried about it. He enjoyed everything about it. And I think you I don't know how you feel about it when you're going around traveling, but I think you can only do it well if you're not actually worried about what you're going to have to say later.
I think it's just enjoy in the moment.
Yes.
Live in that moment and make the most of it. And in our case, eat the most of it as well.
No, that's good. I think actually eating and travel is easier to write about than just travel.
Yes, absolutely.
And our angle is always traveling through food. So every place that we explore is we organize, you know, three lunches, have a drink here, a coffee there, and try to hit as many places as we can. And everybody always comments, A, how can you afford that? And B, how are you so slim still? And we say, I have no idea and I have no idea.
It's all an illusion. Yeah. This is why we're on a podcast now.
It is a wonderful way to travel. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, which is what I like when I go away or when I go anywhere, it's that wonderful planning of everywhere you're going to eat before you go. And I feel like that about restaurants too. I don't go to restaurants an awful lot at home, but when I'm on the road, if I can fit one in, I love it. Mm-hmm. And I just love reading the menus online and thinking about what I could eat. And that's always much part of the joy. And I feel that about cooking, which is that I really like thinking about what I'm going to cook, and there are so many different possibilities as you're planning something, and all those possibilities are rather delicious as you weigh up and think about what you could do, and then the choosing and then the actual cooking and then eating and then thinking about what you've eaten afterwards. I like to stretch it out for as long as possible.
When you do travel, do you visit supermarkets like we do?
I love a supermarket.
Oh my God, isn't it the most fun just to explore a foreign supermarket?
I like Spanish supermarket a lot. Mm. And I've got rather good sort of cake tins and things like that when I've been in foreign supermarkets too.
Churascon was our one in Spain. Yes.
Now I constantly have someone on my shoulder telling me, you will never use that. do not buy it.
Yes. And I have myself on my shoulders, I'm telling myself that.
Reason here yes. in the corner, and he's just extravagance. I want that. I want that.
I'll never be able to get it again, so I have to get it right now type of thing. We did see in the last series in At My Table your armoire.
Yeah, my baking cupboard.
Your baking cupboard.
It has been much more.
Oh, yeah, God,
like
really?
My prep machine and things like that, which I still haven't used.
Okay, so let's one just day. Do it. We have a list of things in our heads of yes. things that you have. Just yes, yes or no what you have. Okay, have you a circle waffle iron? Like a circular one?
No, my waffle iron is not circular, it's square, and it is wonderful. Mm. I am completely evangelical about it because it goes on the hob, it goes yes. On the stove. Mm. Because the thing is, if you've got to keep one of those big machines, where do you keep it? So you're never going to use it, you're going to stash it under the stairs and then you won't use it. So this is really good, and I quite like it. It makes me feel a bit Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, yes, true, yeah. You know? It's gorgeous. lovely cast iron one, isn't it? Yes.
Well, actually, it looks like it's big and cast iron, but it's that clever thing which it's non-stick.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Dream for waffles. What about a dehydrator?
No, but my oven apparently will do dehydrating, but I am not really interested in that lock.
Yeah, read the manual.
Similarly,
now.
I don't have a sous vide machine.
You don't? That was
I
my
don't.
Next one, actually.
No, I thought so, it might yeah. be.
The
no.
lead on.
No.
Have you got a smoking gun?
No, I haven't got a smoking gun.
Oh, they're good.
I would invest in one.
Actually quite fun. Yeah.
Oh, I don't have anything restaurant-y.
No. Oh
but
God.
Carry on.
Yeah.
A
spiralizer.
Well, I have a spiralizer attachment to my KitchenAid mixer, and I went through, I got it, and I did quite like make some other good spooky salads because you can make those loops of things, but then, and as you know, I did it for my shoestring fries, but actually, I don't use it.
I know. Well, come on. What else is there to use it for other than twisty fries at the end of the day? other attachments for said KitchenAid. Meat grinder?
I don't think I have got a meat grinder, and I would quite like one, I have to say. And then I get, and then I start thinking, I might start making sausages, and then I know I won't be doing that.
No.
One day when I retire, I can be doing all that sort of thing.
Oh, I know. It's a lot of work. I think we're in the same conversations now. Let's get a meat grinder. We just moved into a new place, and it's that feeling of we have way too much stuff. And I can't bear to get rid of any of it. No. So we're just trying to find new shelves.
But you've made me want to get a meat grinder now.
Mm. Oh, good.
But you see, it's interesting because when I was a child, my mother had one that would clamp on, a bit like pasta machines. Mm. It clamped onto the table. It was very normal then. Mm. It clamped onto the table. And we'd always do it because in those days, sometime in the 1850s, you would put whatever remains of the Sunday joint, and you would mince it and make a pie, make shepherd's pie or cottage pie or whatever. So it was very normal then. But although I don't think I'll be doing it for that, but it would be good just to make. I think I'll make my own mince, but why not? I've got a good butcher.
Yeah, well, exactly. And just make your own mince, make your own burgers, and then you can be your own butchers. Well, speaking of butchers, you're a huge fan of Hannon's Meats.
Yeah,
as we
I am.
Know. Oh, amazing stuff. So that would actually go very well in a meat grinder.
Absolutely.
I would say. It'd be a sin, but it would also be fantastic.
It would be a sin, but he does himself. I mean, he does those burgers, which have got, is it the three different cuts of meat in?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly which three they are now. I did know, but they are so good. And I got some. He gave me some once, and I cooked some onions, a lot of onions, quite mild white onions. Mm. In this Pat, who does that wonderful lard?
Pat Whelan.
Yeah. So yes. So meet Pete Hannon. Pete Hannon also gave me some Wagyu beef, some Pat Whelan Wagyu beef dripping in Iberico port lard, and I cooked lots of onions for about an hour and a half slowly in Wagyu beef dripping, and then I cooked the burgers in the pan, in a cast iron pan that the onions had cooked in, and it's just the best burger in
that
the
is
world.
Heavy.
I am salivating. Glad we
but
ate
I'll
breakfast.
I'll tell you something that I know that I am not conventional in this. I prefer a burger not in a bun. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm in a hotel, I will. But I like it actually in, I'm not a snob, so I like a bit of it in lots of iceberg lettuce leaves.
Oh.
And I, with all, all bits of dips and just really onion I don't do cheese. And I love that because I feel sometimes a bun makes it too cakey, yeah. and I can't taste the meat enough. In a hotel where that's fine, sometimes, and that's just what you want. But actually, I felt like, and it's, as you know, I have no fear of carbs, but actually when I want a burger at home, I want to taste the meat.
Yeah.
And everything is in brioche now.
I know.
It's either too cakey or too greasy too stale or too, yeah.
But I'll tell you what is nice, and this is what I sometimes do. I went through a spurt of it in enthusiasm some years ago, and I haven't quite managed to do it again, which is I make smaller burger buns and I have some potato in there, or potato water.
Oh, yes.
And it makes them lighter, even though the starch makes it quite lighter. So if you're going to have a bun, I think that works quite well. So I either go double carb or lettuce.
Yeah, which is fair. You have to do it. Have you ever heard of the Waterford Blah?
No.
Oh, it's a very special bread in Ireland. It makes a good burger. It is very floury.
It's a floury roll. Yes.
Oh, how
I think in the north they call it a barm.
Yes, same thing.
It's protected, especially from a region, Waterford, down south in Ireland. So it makes a very good burger. If you spot any about, magically grab some. They're very good.
Pretty hard to find them.
Yeah, you won't get any unless you happen to walk into Waterford
and
at some point.
If you don't use proper Irish water when you make it, it won't taste the same.
No, absolutely not.
Make it with London hard water.
Oh, God, no. And that was a problem for us in our sourdough. Have you a sourdough starter yourself? Or
I have killed many sourdough starters in my time.
It's sad.
I feel like, you know, I don't know whether I can go back to sourdough now that I'm used not to having small children. Do you know, I just don't know if I can take the responsibility all over again.
There's hotels for
that. Not that I killed my children.
No.
But I do I love sourdough. That's another thing. I do like making bread. But there are also so many bakers that make such fantastic bread, and I don't know that domestic ovens are really great for bread.
No.
And it's everywhere in London. It's absolutely everywhere. Over here,
when
you're
in London,
it's harder
you must
to
go
find.
To the Dusty Knuckle.
The Dusty Knuckle.
I love their bread, and they do a potato sourdough, which is so good.
You're singing to us with this potato theme going on now, because of course.
Everything.
Well, do you know what?
I love them.
Do you know what? I think it was in Domestic Goddess that I first made bread using potato water, because it seemed to me that would help. And I made two different potato breads, some with the mashed potato.
Yeah.
And the bread, and some just with the water. And then I thought, well, will it dry? Because, you know, I'm not a snob. Will it work if I use, like, smash instant potato? Just like, if you can't get it, like, you put a teaspoon of granules into the water, and that worked. And then I thought, what happens if you use pasta water as well? Because that's the starch, and that works very well too, and it really makes a difference to bread.
Yeah. We actually use smash for waffles.
Yeah,
it works.
Why
We've
not?
Tried 100,000 times with real potatoes, every other form of them, and smash is the only one that ever seems to work for us. So.
Well, try my potato one. I think, you know what, I think the reason why often why you'd say smash would work better is that people often use very buttery mash that's left over, and then it slightly skews the proportions, whereas, of course, when you use instant mash, it's pretty much just potato, isn't it? Just dehydrated potatoes that you've rehydrated. But, you know, it's quite interesting, because if ever you talk to any, however celebrated and grand and talented and miraculous French chef, if you ever ask them what food they love or miss the most, it's that instant mash that all French children are given. You know, the flocon, whatever it's called, and they love it. I mean, they do add milk and butter and cream, and I don't know what to it, but nearly all French chefs have this incredible nostalgia for instant mash.
And there's so much of it. We were in France last week in the supermarkets. I couldn't get over how much French mash there is.
Yes.
Tempted.
Alio.
God. Oh, Aligot.
Aligot, yeah.
Oh, my God, that's so good,
but
isn't it?
But it's in the cheese oil. This is the best part.
Yeah?
It's so much cheese in it. It's not even in the potato oil.
But it is much more like a potato-y fondue.
Oh, God, that sounds incredible.
Speaking of recipes, what do you cook at home when you aren't creating a book, and when you've had a hard day and you're in the kitchen and you just want to check out and stir for an hour or...
Oh, well, that so depends what I've got. You know, as you know, you cook. So when you cook, it really depends what you've got. I just open my fridge and then I love that. For me, just opening my fridge or a cupboard and seeing, you know, where I'm going to go with it is the thing I love the most. So I think It really depends. There are times when I just do, and it depends whether I've got the kids there or not as well. So Risi e Bisi, that Venetian, you know, Risi e Bisi is rice and peas in Venetian dialect, which is I rather love. And it's a cross between a soup and a risotto. And it's very easy. You don't stir it all the time, although I do love, you know, stirring. You know, in my, in, I think it was kitchen, I've got a whole chapter on risotto called The Solace of Stirring. So I like, I do like to make a risotto, but I like to make Risi e Bisi as well. And I've always got the wherewithal with that because it's really risotto rice, and I'm not ashamed of using, you know, stock out of a concentrate. Frozen peas. I mean, obviously the real recipe is you make a stock out of the pea pods and use the fresh peas. And I have done that in my time, but I actually make it from frozen peas because I make it all the year round. Yeah. And you know, some cheese and parmesan, whatever, I parsley. I sometimes bring, you know, because the English thing of using mint with peas, I will then add sometimes a bit of mint as well. But it's just, that is just so wonderful because there's a way in which when you're exhausted, there's something very reassuring about every mouthful being the same as the last. Yeah, and I love that. Yeah. But sometimes I'll tell you what I really like. I don't know whether I should tell you or not because I think it will really disgust a lot of your listeners, which is the thing I make when I haven't got enough ingredients at home or I'm too tired to do an awful lot. I have whatever vegetables I've got, so say it might be kale or cabbage, and I cook that, and I cook that the way my mother did, which is I almost stir fry it with some seeds to start off with. It could be cumin or it could be fennel, it could be, and my mother always did cabbage and caraway seeds, but I don't use caraway seeds for this, so it's cumin or fennel, and sometimes for a bit of coloured nigamania, I might do nigella seeds. And then I add some water, so it's sort of stir-fried but steamed, and then I drain it, and in that pan, I always keep really good sardines, and I add those, and then I add some lemon zest and a bit of lemon juice, and then I add the vegetables back in, and then I either do toasted pine nuts or sometimes some walnuts on top, it depends what I'm, but, and so I tend to do walnuts with the green vegetables, but if I have any cauliflower, sometimes I roast that, and then I chop up the sardines and bung it in the tin quickly at the last minute to heat up with the cauliflower, pine nuts, and a lot of parsley. It's so delicious, and it's like I know I can eat something.
I'm salivating. Wow. That sounds great. I can't believe you think that would disgust. I suppose sardines, people.
Sardines
such
sound
a thing.
So horrible.
It's like anchovies. You put anchovies. They're
sprats.
Just so good. Sprats.
Yeah, I love all that. Yeah. But you see, in a way, I like that with pasta too. You can make great sauces with anchovies or with sardines. But sometimes when I'm want something quickly, I actually feel that I need the vegetables.
Yeah.
And it's that thing of that mixing. And in fact, what I had it for breakfast before I was traveling because I didn't know when I'd eat again. And I added a poached egg to my sardines and kale.
Perfect. Why not?
And then when you did eat again, it was a fabulous cheese board.
Yes, it was a fabulous cheese board from Sheridan's. Inhaled it.
Oh,
lovely
good.
Bread too.
Yeah. Yeah. You tried out one of our favourite cheeses as well. They're all our favourite cheeses. Young Buck.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes, it's wonderful. Yeah. It really is gorgeous. Yeah.
Mm. He only creates one cheese and one cheese only, and that Young Buck has taken over Ireland over the past year or two, and he cannot keep up with the demand because everybody just absolutely adores it. Even if you aren't into a blue cheese, I think it's the perfect
introduction. I think it's wonderful, but I am into a blue cheese. Blue cheese is life.
The first ever recipe in How to Eat is a roast chicken.
Yeah.
And it feels like roast chicken has kind of come through the 20 years as quite an iconic thing. Yeah. So how important is a roast chicken?
So important. It's like the basic unit of home for me. And I don't know, I suppose when I make a roast chicken, I suppose it's changed over the years. In How to Eat, I use butter. And now quite often I might use butter, I might use oil, but I put a lemon inside like my mother did, and my home smells in that same chickeny, lemony fug, which I adore. And I feel that it's really, I think it speaks to so many people, but for me, it is certainly what I need, especially when I've been traveling. Mm-hmm. I will either make that or I will make my mother's, you know, chicken in a pot, my mother's praise chicken. And I feel sometimes I almost do it without taking my coat off because I need to establish that I'm back at home.
Yeah. And it's the smell, it's the and it's the routine of making it.
It's the routine and the simplicity. Mm. And I have to say, for me, that is home, and I think it is for so many people.
Mm-hmm. You speak about having to head on the road and travel a lot, and at the minute you're on a tour. How are you finding that?
I'm finding it fun. Yeah. I love it. Mm. You know, my overwhelming worry when I'm on the road is whether I'm going to have time to eat and what I'm going to eat. So as long as I get that sorted out, mm-hmm. Because one of the things often is that you often work at lunchtime, you work in the evening, so you miss out meals. But I've managed to get quite a bit of good food under my belt, so I'm feeling buoyant.
Mm. And got some more to come as well.
Yes, but it's interesting. One of the best, yes. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I never leave home without food of my own either. Because you've always got to have food in case in case you should miss a meal.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And in case you get stuck in traffic or anything like that.
Anything
always
like
good
that.
To have.
Always got to have something.
No
like that.
Hanger.
But you know, I do like. So, for example, like coming to Dublin, I do want to get Sheridan's cheese because I love it. And it's the thing is, it's just actually having a bit like that's so much part of traveling is to eat food of that comes from where you're going, you know? That's like when I was in the Northeast, when I had my mince and dumplings, and I was only very sorry not to have the ham shank and peas pudding.
And a parmy.
And a parmy.
Yes.
a parmy. Looks so good. You're taking this tour to Australia, and you've spoken many, many times about your love of Australia and its food there. It's quite a long time.
Have you
time.
Been to Australia?
No, we're dying to go. We're absolutely dying to go. I think we only got to Asia this year.
Yes.
We only got to Taiwan this year.
I think you'd be really quite fascinated, and I think you should, you know, be quite good to take the podcast there.
Oh, Outback Podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I like
Don't
the sound of that. Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. It's quite a long time.
A lot of people to chew the fat with in Australia and New Zealand.
And Aussies like to talk. Which is fab, so...
Not that you do.
No,
would be helpful, wouldn't it?
No, exactly. I'm a silent one. it's quite a long time, actually, that tour in particular, to be away from home. And you've done it now a couple of times over the years.
Mm. Well, I've done it since my children have grown up.
Yeah. So have you...
Nothing bad in missing, you know, 6 weeks of, you know, of the winter.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm the odd thing is I do love being in Australia and I love New Zealand, but you know, I'm a bit of a sun phobe.
Mm.
I don't have the skin to go in the sun. Neither you
two. Irish, hello.
But there is, and so when I go to Australia in January, they always say, you must be so pleased to be out of the cold. And I always say, no, I don't mind the cold. It's the dark I can't cope with. And I have to say, being in Australia and New Zealand in January and February when you have these big blue skies is really beautiful and uplifting. It's a great way to start the year.
Would you cook a lot when you're down under, I guess?
No. And that is difficult. I don't cook a lot because you're in hotels and I miss that. But I do occasionally go to people's houses and that's great.
I have to lunch. I will be murdered for not telling you this. There's a place called Hague's in Adelaide. There's a chocolate bar called Coffee Crunch one. You must try it when you're in Adelaide, okay?
I will.
It's very good. It is very good. One of our friends swears by it.
Am
so,
I?
Yeah, that's checked off the list.
But it's interesting, and there is something quite wonderful about the Australian food, the way it's so... It's mixed. It's found its voice a bit, and I think that its own identity.
Mm. Yes, the indigenous cuisine there in particular is amazing. And when actually we were travelling to Taiwan back a couple of months ago and obviously the communities of all around that region, and probably the best meal I think we've ever had was in a tiny, tiny restaurant in the middle of the mountains, Alishan Mountains, and I cried leaving it. It was that type of feeling of, I'm never going to be able to come back here. Well, I might, but you know.
And what did you eat?
There was a platter. There was chicken with raw red onions.
Yeah.
So it was kind of braised and then fried. There was lots of sticky rice. There was kind of pan-fried cabbage with heavy with garlic. There was slow-cooked aubergines, and so it was. It was all quite simple stuff, but it was clearly home-cooked and cooked with love.
And it's the ingredients too.
Yeah.
It must be something to do with the soil.
Yeah.
Oh no.
The soil and the sun.
Yes, exactly.
And it was lashing rain outside, and all of us were.
See, that's
at
good as well. That's like
table.
Ireland, you see.
Yeah.
You've got this wonderful soil and the rain, and that's why the ingredients are so good.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we are blessed in this country with the ingredients.
That's why your skin is so good, and it's why your ingredients are so good.
Exactly, and why we're always walking around without umbrellas, because we're stupid. We never remember.
I'd rather get wet than hold an umbrella.
Yeah, same.
Completely, or what's the point in a hood? When you go to restaurants, as we are going to later on, you will walk in there, and people will instantly go, oh my God, is that Nigella?
Well, not always,
no?
You know.
Does not happen.
I don't know. It's hard to say.
It's
some
an
might,
internal thing for us.
Some
suppose.
Might.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I don't know that I'm looking out for it. I don't expect people to recognise me, you know?
And I think it's a great thing as well, actually, to be like that, too.
I'm really, do you know what? I'm just going, all I do when I go to restaurants is I look at the tables to see what I want to eat.
Yes.
So I don't actually look at the people.
Yeah.
Although I do like staring at people. I am nosy. Mm. And I like hearing the conversations.
Yes.
But mostly I am, as I come in, I'm doing a quick, you know, in, is it Terminator, when you see them looking and everything's being scanned?
Yes.
I do a scan of the food and the tables, and I have to say to the people who work in the restaurant, what's that table eating? Is that the, you know? I think we did that when we were at Eto last time. I did an awful lot of staring at the people's food and the next table and saying, can we have some of that?
Yes.
And you know what, once, this is awful, this was some time ago, I think I was younger, so people didn't mind as much, but I did once eat a chip off someone else's table without,
oh my God.
Without actually being aware of doing
Hero.
It.
Your just hand just wanders
you
know, over.
If you see a plate of chips, your hand just goes in and takes one.
Exactly.
When I'm on the road, I love it. Mm. And obviously I eat out more than I ever do at home because I don't eat out a lot at home. Mm. But I do really miss cooking. And I get in, by the end of my trip abroad, I'm in a fervour of sort of excitement and sort of pent up need to cook.
Yeah.
And I sometimes, you know, never mind expense, I sometimes will phone up my butcher at home and order stuff to be delivered for when I get back.
Perfect.
And I remember last time I was just so obsessed about making this particular meat sauce, and I think I'd been in America for a long time, you know, and I suppose everything's so lean, and I had this obsession about making a meat sort of meat sauce that we'd eat, or mince, when I was a child, which was much less tomatoey than you'd get now.
Yeah.
Just a lot of onion, slow cooked mince, and I put a marrow bone in it too, so it was really sticky and fatty and wonderful. And that's that, I, you know what I mean? And that was because I was, you know, lying about in the hotel rooms thinking about what I wanted to cook when I got home.
It's like counting sheep, or actually, how would that taste?
Yes. You know, so I do feel. And then also some certain things that I eat when I'm there that I find quite inspiring. But obviously, if you're going to the other side of the world, you're going to do it with different ingredients. Mm. But you get ideas for the way flavours and textures have been put together.
Yeah.
Mm. And sometimes, actually, because I miss cooking, I go a bit freestyle in a restaurant. So when I was in Australia, for example, I ate for the first time. This is a old indigenous ingredient, but it's quite trendy now in Australian restaurants, which is called a finger lime.
Yeah.
If you come across a finger lime,
only through you.
Yes. So, so if I were to describe it, I'd say it's kind of it's got the shape of a small squat sausage, and the skin is more like a kiwi fruit skin. It is in colour, but it is a lime. And then you open it, and it's a lime, but instead of having those long segments that you'd get in a normal lime, they're actually round, and it's often sometimes they're called caviar limes. They come out in perfect little spheres of, and they burst on your tongue as you eat them, and they use them quite a lot on ceviche and various other things. But I love the oysters in Australia. Mm. And once I've done my work, I won't eat oysters if I'm about to go on stage, but when I've done my work, I have oysters, and I said in a restaurant, oh, can you get me a teeny bit of finger lime from the kitchen? And just adding a few little bits of the finger lime to the oyster was so good. And also, like, it's with gin and tonic. They pop, the citrus pop in your mouth. It's wonderful.
We need to get them imported here
somehow. Well, they are importing them, and I think they are importing. They are very expensive because, of course, they grow in certain parts of Australia. They grow a lot, but otherwise, but they will import them. But I don't know whether, and apparently a lot of Australians told me when I spoke about them that if you can get them and bring them back, you can keep them in the freezer.
Ah, perfect.
Very
That's
good
what
to
they
know.
Said. Anyway,
well,
they are
freezer.
Rather wonderful.
Yes,
don't. No room.
No more space.
Yeah, you could probably fit a finger line.
Yeah.
They're quite small. They've got a finger
somewhere.
Line for a reason.
Exactly.
<They're not> big.
Yeah.
And you were telling us about eating chips off other people's plates.
Yeah.
So where have you found the best chips on earth?
Oh, it's an ongoing search. And I'm very sorry to say that it's very... Well, in London, it's hard to get good chips. And I Everyone goes on and on about how many times they fry the chip, but they're too often machine cut. And the whole point about chips is that if they're machine cut, they're too smooth. And if they're too smooth, they don't catch in the right way. So I think it's very difficult to get really good chips. Any helpful pointers, I'd be grateful for. They don't fry them enough either. They're too
dripping
blonde.
Dripping is important.
Yeah, the Irish do it in dripping.
I know. So Burdocks I've had chips in before. That I think it's difficult because I think when they're machine cut, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
But I don't cook chips very often because I have an open plan house. But I do sometimes, and it's worth it because I do think egg and chips is one of the great meals.
Yes.
You had that yesterday, right?
Yeah, but I had it with a steak underneath it.
Yeah, and ham eggs and chips also good. Yeah. But I used to, Saturday night, when my children were younger, like for a treat, I'd sometimes do ham, egg and chips. But for me, actually, I'm just happy to have egg and chips. But I'm thinking of erecting some sort of tent for deep frying. I've got a small garden, very small, and I'm thinking of doing a bit of deep frying out there. Because
the
then
perfect place for it.
Wouldn't it be? Yeah,
if you need anyone to help, you know where we are.
I think one of the most iconic scenes of your shows ever that I think is the chip kebab and the
so
hummus
delicious.
And the flatbread and salt. And
lemon.
And it's the words at the end of it. Apply to face. Oh my God, I don't know how many times in life I've used that expression. It's just one of the greatest
and
ways.
Use that as the title of your next book, Apply to Face, because it's just perfect.
No, we.
Well, you're welcome to use it.
Okay, fine. We are chip aficionados, as we say, so it's nice to have a nice chat about them in that way.
They're fabulous. You know, in certain moods, even a bad chip will do, but not really.
Mm.
And I'm not a fries person either.
Thick.
Yes.
They have to be.
I do like that. But I'm got, you know, I won't turn down a potato wedge either.
No.
I like all potatoes. Mm. I don't know if you saw the other day someone called Josh Barry.
Love Josh.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay, so Josh Barry tweeted saying that he'd been out for dinner and someone had said, "You've got to put in order." It was bread, potatoes, pasta, rice, and whatever order you do, you're going to think, oh, I've made the mistake. I reserve the right to change my mind, and mine goes bread, potatoes, pasta, rice.
Exactly.
I think.
Yeah.
Although
interchangeable at the top, maybe.
I think, no, because I feel that a life without bread is such an uncivilized life.
Mm.
You know, remember. The idea is not like which are you going to not have, it's the order. So as long as you can have all of them.
Yes.
And I don't know, maybe pasta and rice could also be interchangeable. I put rice at the end, but then you think risotto, rice pudding, and I don't know. But I think that maybe. I think I am, for the time being, I'm standing by bread, potatoes, pasta, rice.
Mm. I would say that's where I would stand too.
Yeah. It's not.
I've talked to you out of getting potatoes first.
Yeah. I'm a potato fan for life, so.
Irish. No, I understand
pride.
That.
It's crushed now.
Yeah.
Maybe if I lived in Ireland, I'd put potatoes first, you see. See, can I just talk to you about potatoes?
Yes, please.
I feel that there is, the potatoes I'm buying at the moment are not as good as they used to be, and I think they are picking them and selling them when they're not quite ready. That's my view.
I grew some this year for the first time, and they were the best crop out of everything.
Yeah.
I could not grow a cabbage.
Yeah.
I could not grow a broccoli. I could not grow
the state of that carrot.
Chard or anything. But the potatoes absolutely flourished.
But
the problem was that some were absolutely huge and others were teeny tiny.
Yeah.
So I don't know, are they planting them too close together? Are they?
I don't know, but I think they're underripe because they never go quite fluffy enough. Mm. And there's something when you cut, I can tell when I'm peeling or chopping them, there's almost not a greenness, but they don't feel right.
Yeah.
I mean, I sometimes go to a farmer's market and get potatoes and then they're very good.
Mm.
But, you know, as long as it's, but I think the ones that I would get just generally are sadly disappointing.
Mm.
Speaking of potato.
Yeah. Tato. Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Tato. How could we not?
I know, you've waited so long.
How could we not? Tato.
Yes.
You had the battle of them last night.
No, I didn't. It was really interesting. Because generally speaking, if you were to say to me, what's your favourite crisp flavour? I would say salt and vinegar, without any question. So when I wanted some crisps at the interval of the show yesterday, I got some salt and vinegar ones. Mm-hmm. And then I tasted some cheese and onion, and the cheese and onion were better, I think. And I'm not a cheese and onion fan, but the tato ones are out of this world.
They are. And everybody across the universe agrees they're the best cheese and onion crisps.
And Niamh, you know, who was interviewing me last night, said that when she was at school there, her home economics teacher used to crumble the cheese and onion tato crisps on top of a macaroni cheese.
Yes, I've heard that a lot.
You had a crisp sandwich before?
Oh, my sister's favourite was a crisp sandwich. Yeah. Of course I've had a crisp sandwich in my life. Honestly, what kind of a person do you think?
Stupid question.
I mean, you know, but we're not talking sourdough here we talk about the bread. No, we're talking about, you know, plastic white bread.
Yeah, 25p reduced yellow sticker. Get that. Pop, tato, cheese and onion, and lashings of butter.
Yeah.
But you have to keep a little bit of the crisp packet at the end. So basically you have your crisp sandwich. Yeah. And crisps as a side.
Yes, that makes sense.
Makes a meal.
That makes sense.
I mean, it's elegant.
Anyway, it's delicious. I was talking about last night, I don't like the snobbery of food. I mean, so many things taste wonderful. And there are, you know, there are moments when I like a cheese triangle spread on white bread. You know, other times that doesn't mean to say I don't absolutely adore, some young buck cheese. You know, it's not either or. Mm-hmm.
And I think so many people forget that with food.
They
forget
to enjoy. They're so eager to show that they've got good taste with a capital G and a capital T, or they're cool, or they're hip, or they want to join a particular gang. And I'm not really interested in that.
And kind of on that, the perfection world that we live in now, which is Instagram, Twitter,
the modern world, the anxious perfectionism of the modern world, which erodes any pleasure.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to food, you touched on it last night about food waste. Mm. When it's, you know, you see these people taking photos of food, and you're like, how are you going to eat all that? You know, we're very yourself included that you eat what you're putting up. And you'll enjoy it, you know.
But also, it's not just that. It's that sometimes you feel that these are people. It's not even that they can't eat all that much. You can tell by them they are not eaters, and it almost it's actually worse because it's such an unhealthy relationship with food to feel that consuming it is dangerous and taking photographs of it is, you know, in inverted commas, safe. And I don't like that. Mm. But in a way, this isn't, just because you said the words food waste, it makes me feel that if you like cooking, that, you know, waste is anathema, and you want to use everything. The other day, I don't know if you saw on Instagram, I'd made an oxtail stew in How to Eat.
Yeah.
It had Mackeson, and I use Guinness milk stout, because that's what I get. So it was a milk stout and marjoram, and it's got mace, and it's wonderful. And I had a friend of mine who's, doesn't do carbs, okay? So I feel I'll accommodate. So I made cauliflower mash because you need some sort of mash with the oxtail, and because you need quite a lot of cauliflower. I had used two cauliflowers for it. I mean, only two of us eating, but then never mind. And so I had quite a lot of the leaves there, and I cooked them to go with. And so many people said on Instagram or Twitter, "I didn't know you could eat the leaves." And you think, like, what? It's a leaf it's a leaf on a vegetable.
Yeah. I love a broccoli stalk.
So do I.
I absolutely adore that. It almost tastes more broccoli-y than...
I think it's in Simply. I've got a really nice recipe with ginger and lime when you cook them two separately. But it's... So I like all that. Yeah. And often that's the best ideas in cooking, is not to have waste. But I feel it's like I always say to people, I am very extravagant, but I'm never wasteful. Mm. That I know I spend a lot on food. Mm. And I know that, in a way, it's... You know, I'm always... I used to have to hide my shopping when I came in because I felt like I had so much food shopping and bits to go in the cupboard. But I won't. But I don't waste it, and I enjoy every bit of it, and I eke it out to use it how I can.
Mm. Fried potato skins, carrot top pesto, all those types of things. And it's just a brilliant way of using it.
And stock and vegetable stock.
Of course, the simplest of them all. Mm. Yeah.
At the show last night, I was really, really impressed with the Q&A because, more than asking questions, the audience, every single person, was more an outpouring of love.
It was so
to you, and it was all about the connection that they've had to you through food. And I just thought that that was really, really special, that rather than just wanting to ask a question, they wanted to let you know how you had transformed their cookery, or you had impacted on an area of their lives, I guess.
Know. It was very touching, wasn't it? And it was so... It, that, for me, is, I suppose, what it's about. And it moves me very profoundly. And that's why, and it's that sense of connection I do love. And it is about the food, but it's about other things too. The woman who's, you know, who was talking about her brother dying, mm-hmm. and really experiencing that, and in terms of the food that they ate. Yeah. And I think that that's what food is. It's really, it's about the whole of life. And there has to be room for a conversation yeah. about that and yeah. with people. And I try and do it through my books. But if I'm, when I'm on the road like this and I meet people, that to me is, it's so good to hear the voices back, that I'm not just giving my voice and I'm hearing and yeah. I'm having a conversation. And it is chat. And it's, as I said, you know, in a bit in the beginning, it's chat, but it can be about the everyday, and it can be about loss, and it can be about joy. Yeah. And all these things come into food.
And food is omnipresent in your life. You know, yeah. it's the first thing you eat, well, you should eat in the day, and so on and so forth. It's a constant for everyone. When it comes to the shows, I guess how many thousands of people are coming along to them? Like last night, I think it was 4,000 people, and then obviously you meet.
Well,
I think it's 4,000 is capacity of their.
Right.
Yeah,
I don't
3,000.
Think so, but I'll go for it.
Go for take it.
Yes.
Take the compliment. But you do the signings at the end,
yes.
And
I love it.
Love
and I always say to
too.
People, I tell you what I would say, because I always say to people, you know, you don't have to buy a book. Bring your old spattered yeah. ones. I love that. I love to see the ones where, you know, which recipes, where the pages are stuck together and
yeah.
and the notes. If they've written notes in the margin, that can slow
them.
Me down.
Yeah. You're like, how did you improve this?
No, I like that. And I like, yeah. you know, I like yeah. that.
I think when we came to your signing here a year or two ago, we chose the books that we have used the most that are falling apart or splattered or torn.
Because like a lot of people in the media, especially in this 20th anniversary of How to Eat, a lot of people have been speaking about, you know, when they got the book first and everything like that. I was 6 at the time and you were 8, I suppose. So it's kind of like, for us, our first books were the likes of Express. In fact,
yes.
actually, the first book we bought together was yeah. Express. But it was because in the early parts of our relationship, we all just watched 30 Rock and Food Network. And we yeah. just on repeat, just constantly watched Express. So it was very important to us. But they read like storybooks. And
well,
that's
I love
the thing about
say,
it.
Stories, you know, and I was saying last night that we human beings, we have a thirst for narrative and for connection. And I think that when I write about food, for me, it's about both those things. But you know, you were saying about, you were 6, but you know, some of the people who come to me with How to Eat is that they were almost weaned on the baby food in there, because all my books have a sort of autobiographical element in the sense they're the story of my life where it is then, and my kids were babies. And so there's a whole chapter in How to Eat on weaning and feeding the babies and small children.
Yeah.
And sometimes someone will say, do you know why my daughter was raised on that food, all those mad purees I went in for, and then they gave them the book when they went to uni. You know, and that's a wonderful thing. Yeah. So
it really passes it down through the generations.
There are some odd combinations in my weaning chapter, I have to say.
I must try them.
not on me. No baby food.
You talked about writing, and I think that your writing in particular has probably inspired a generation who will come after you. But who inspired how you write?
Oh, in a way, I think that I've read forever since I was a very small child. And I think in many ways, it's not food writers that have inspired me. It's just the feeling of being, it's the joy of reading and being so pleasurably immersed in a sentence and enjoying the taste of that sentence. I think there are a lot of food writers that I wouldn't say particularly have inspired me in the sense of I want to write like them, but I'm very inspired by their approach to food. Jane Grigson, for example, the stories of ingredients and the sense that there's a sort of hinterland of enormous knowledge, and that when you're reading the book, you're in the company of a wonderful, elucidating intelligence and a wryness, which I like. Anna Del Conte I've spoken about, because I feel, again, that I learn about the context of the food, and I like the way she writes. I like the certain wryness of her style, and she wears her erudition very lightly. But there are so many writers. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read Laurie Colwin.
No.
I was very glad that I only came across her when I was halfway through How to Eat, otherwise it would have made me not able to write. It's wonderful. So she was a short story writer predominantly. She was also a novelist, and it's called Home Cooking, and I think its subtitle is A Novelist in the Kitchen. And it's really essays about food and life, and you must read it, and that's okay. So wonderful.
That's our homework.
Yeah.
It's just, so homework makes it sound like an obligation.
No. Yeah.
That's a joy ahead.
That's your gift to us.
Yeah.
Let's think of it like that. You use your platform in particular to, in a lot of ways, elevate a lot of young writers in particular, which we think is one of the sweetest things you can do as young writers ourselves.
I love that, but I think, you know, just like I like sharing my enthusiasm about food, I like to share my enthusiasms about, you know, writers and people who, you know, exploring food in a different way. I tell you what I think as well, which is you should never jealously guard your position, because I've been very lucky to do what I love doing, and I will continue to do it as long as I love doing it and people will tolerate me. But in the sense of, you don't go on forever, and you really want really good people to come up. And there are so many talented people out there, and it's my joy to enthuse about them, and I love that. It's one of the great, I think it's one of the great benefits of my position, is that I can encourage other people. And, you know, I had a wonderful agent who died a year or so ago called Ed Victor, and he was American, and he had a wonderful saying, which is, he used to say to me, you've got to send the elevator back down. And I think that is absolutely crucial in life.
Some of the writers in particular that we can think of, like Olia Hercules in particular, and I just love your love for her and for people like her who are doing what they do. And where do you see now the future of food writing? Because it's so visual these days in a lot of cases.
But I think, you know what? I think people still have that thirst for story. And Olia's food is wonderful, but what people also want from her and get from her is the story of why that particular cooking means something to her, and her explaining it to us. You know, if she's writing about Georgian food, she explains what it is and the stories that it tells her, and that's very vivid. And I think people do need stories. So yes, people go onto Instagram and they want those pictures, but at the heart of it, they don't. They want more than that. Otherwise food books would have stopped selling. People wouldn't be writing them, and people go for voice. You know, I think that in a way it's one of the reasons why the restaurant books aren't as big as they used to be, because people don't want to just see what they do in a restaurant. It amazes me sometimes that there are still books being sold that you just couldn't cook from at home. And I think that's an odd thing. But I think more and more people are seeking out those who speak to them and feel that you're in company when you read a book. And it can be quite obscure, you see, that's the thing. It can be obscure or it can be everyday.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, as long as you're feeling like you're with a particular person as you read that book, and that person is with you in your kitchen. I think that's very important. Or with you, you know, you're lying on the sofa reading it and just thinking, oh, I'm going to cook that one day, and putting your post-its in. Yeah. I love that. I like a wallow.
Speaking of books, are you working on the next one?
Not working on the next one. I have a few ideas some I have had ideas for a long time, and the books which I've nearly done and I haven't done, it hasn't been ready, and I have got some ideas, but because I've been on the road a lot, I haven't done enough pottering about in my kitchen, and I don't ever want to do a book just for the sake of doing a book. I have to feel I'm really desperate to do it, and I want to do it, and I'm sort of bubbling with enthusiasm, and the recipes are just right. And the more books you do, the harder it is, because you know, there are only so many recipes. You think so. Every time I finish a book, I think that's it. That's me done. and then I'm going in the kitchen. I'm suddenly cooking something else, and it's new, and then it goes from there. So I would like to. I have got. And there's two, maybe three ways it could go, and I don't know until I'm pottering about.
And are there any ingredients that are inspiring you at this moment in time right now?
Well, right now, I don't feel there's not an ingredient I haven't used before that's inspiring me. I can't stop with preserved lemons. You know, I said that last night, but I can't stop with preserved lemons, and they are so good. I like all citrus. But I don't know. But often when I get inspired by an ingredient, it's by mistake. You know, I don't seek out the new. Mm-hmm. I think I quite like the familiar, but because every time I cook, I do it in a slightly different way, depending on what I've got at home. Mm. That's what makes it new, rather than actually striving after originality, which I think can be a misbegotten exercise. Mm-hmm.
I remember it was a signing pre-GG days, as we call it, when we were just known as Russell and Patrick, rather than the singular. Yeah. And it was around this time of year, because the publishing schedule, you'll always be kind of visiting places around this time. And in Dubray Books, you did your signing. And another iconic scene of ours is the Hokey Pokey. The Hokey Pokey, which you consume all of in the car.
Yes.
And it just makes me laugh every time I think about it.
You know what? In a way, when you do a food programme, that it's a very difficult dance between, I suppose, a slight fantasy element, you know, the prettiness and the enchantment. Yes. A programme has to enchant, and I work with people who make things look very beautiful, but the recipes have to be absolutely reliable, practical. Mm. You have to be able to understand by watching the recipe exactly how to cook something. Mm. And it's getting that mixture right. Because, of course, sometimes people don't understand that I'm actually teasing, or it's a joke, you know, because, of course, we understand that it's also television and there's a camera there, do you know, and it's not a documentary.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, I think the thing with television is that, you know, it's an artificial medium, but it's a great phoniness detector, and you just have to be who you are. Mm,
yeah.
But of course, you're who you are in an idealized fashion.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like now, you know, hair and makeup, the lighting is flattering. You don't see, you're not seeing the kitchen towel and the mess. And, you know, my cameraman will never allow a kitchen towel or washing up liquid or rubber gloves into a scene.
But in your own kitchen, it's everywhere.
Even so, I try and make it beautiful, because I think actually, as much as you can have beautiful things around you in the everyday, it makes you feel better.
Mm. With the Hokey Pokey, I actually brought you some to that signing. You hear of a lot of people saying that they bring you gifts and everything like that. We brought you a few Irish things today.
Oh,
just
grab
us the bag there, Patrick.
Oh.
Okay. Just a few things, because now we're very aware of flight limitations, so we couldn't get quite all the things. But you had the cheese before, the Gubin chorizo.
Yes.
Have you tried this yet?
No, I can't wait.
It is incredible. Smoky chorizo from County Cork.
Oh,
absolutely
wow.
Beautiful. We've also got, now you have your Maldon sea salt.
Yes, I do.
I can't dare push you away from it.
Sorry, I've just dropped a thing noisily.
Ackle Island over at West Sea Salt. This is a smoked one.
I love smoked salt.
This one is an especially delicious one. We've got some garlic. This is grown actually just about 5 minutes down the road from us. Elephant garlic.
That looks like it's smoked. Is it smoked?
That one isn't, no, but they do have a smoked one too.
No, just only because of the colour. Elephant garlic, wow.
Yeah. And it's one of two garlic productions in Ireland.
Thank you.
And it's fantastic stuff in Drummond House.
Oh, I can't wait for that. I love garlic. I could do with that, because as you can hear, I'm sounding slightly coldy.
And have you heard about a spice bag yet?
No.
Oh my goodness, a spice bag. Okay, so
the initiation time.
Okay, here it is. And if you enjoy chips, you actually probably will love this. So Irish takeaways have a tradition of sometimes bastardizing a lot of cuisines.
Yeah.
And a spice bag is a perfect example of this. It's basically chips with shredded battered chicken with a secret spice.
Yes.
And for healthiness, it has a couple of vegetables thrown in on top.
So like onions, chilies.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the basic. This is a seasoning for it.
Oh.
Now, you mentioned you have a Asian part of your cupboard. So this may or may not go into it. But it's an interesting
that's
flavor.
Wonderful.
It tastes great on chips, as we were talking about it earlier on. So
salt, star, anise, fennel, cardamom, Chinese cassia, peppercorns, ginger. Fantastic.
Just don't do what we did, which was we actually coated all our chicken in it. We didn't read the fact it was a seasoning. We thought it was a coating.
Oh,
and as we're eating it, our faces just shrunk inside ourselves because it was so salty. And then we were like,
oh, that's so good. Yeah. I look forward to that.
And there's a few other things, including some tato.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, a choice. Nigella Lawson, thank you for coming on Chew the Fat with us.